Disc 7.
Mrs. Paulson, what brings you here today? Special Agent Weber asks.
I don't know, she replies. I came for the report. They're supposed to give me Julie's jewelry. She has a pair of earrings she was wearing and a bracelet, a little leather bracelet she never took off. They said the chief wanted to say hello to me.
You're here for this meeting? The FBI agent asks with a puzzled look on her attractive, well-maintained face.
I don't know.
You're here for Jilly's reports and belongings? Scarpetta asks, as it begins to enter her mind that a mistake has been made.
Yes. I was told I could come by for them at 9. I haven't been able to come here before now. I just couldn't. I have a check written because there's a fee,
Mrs. Paulson says with the same scared look in her eyes.
Maybe I'm not supposed to be in here. Nobody said anything about a meeting.
Yes, well, while you're here, says Special Agent Weber, let me ask you a question, Mrs. Paulson. You remember when we talked the other day? You said your husband, your former husband, is a pilot. Is that correct?
No, he's not a pilot. I said he wasn't.
Oh, okay, because I couldn't find any record of his ever having a pilot's license of any type, Special Agent Weber replies. So I was a little confused. She smiles.
A lot of people assume he's a pilot,
Mrs. Paulson says. Understandably.
He likes to spend time with pilots, especially military ones. He especially likes women pilots. I've always known what he's about,
Mrs. Paulson says dully.
You'd have to be blind, deaf, and dumb not to know what he's about.
Could you elaborate on that? Special Agent Weber asks.
Oh, he gives the pilots physicals. If you can imagine, she says. That's what floats his boat. A woman comes in wearing a flight suit. You can just imagine.
You've heard stories about him sexually harassing female pilots? Special Agent Weber asks somberly.
He always denies it and gets away with it, she adds. You know he has a sister in the Air Force. I've always wondered if it has to do with that. She's quite a lot older than him.
It is at this precise moment that Dr. Marcus walks into the conference room. He wears another white cotton shirt, a sleeveless undershirt showing through it, and his tie is dark blue and narrow. His eyes drift past Scarpetta and fix on Mrs. Paulson. I don't believe we've met, he says to her in an authoritative but cordial tone. Mrs. Paulson, Dr. Scarpetta says, this is the chief medical examiner, Dr. Marcus.
Did one of you invite Mrs. Paulson?
He looks at Scarpetta, then at Special Agent Weber.
I'm afraid I'm confused.
Mrs. Paulson gets up from the table, her movements slow and muddled, as if her limbs are communicating different messages to each other.
I don't know what's happened. I just came for the paperwork and her little gold heart earrings and the bracelet.
I'm afraid it's my fault, Scarpetta says, getting up too. I saw her waiting and made an assumption. I apologize.
That's right, Dr. Marcus says to Mrs. Paulson. I heard you might come by this morning. Please let me express my sympathy.
He smiles his condescending smile.
Your daughter is a very high priority here.
Oh,
Mrs. Paulson replies. I'll walk you out. Scarpetta opens the door for her. I'm truly sorry, she says as they walk along the gray-blue carpet, past the coffee machine, and into the main corridor. I hope I haven't embarrassed or upset you.
Tell me where Julie is,
she says, stopping in the middle of the corridor.
I have to know. Please tell me exactly where she is.
Scarpetta hesitates. Such questions are not unusual for her, but they are never simple to answer. Julie is on the other side of those doors. She turns around and points down the length of the corridor to a set of doors. Beyond them is another set of doors, then the morgue and its coolers and freezers.
I suppose she's in a coffin. I've heard about the pine boxes places like this have,
Mrs. Paulson says, her eyes filling with tears. No, she's not in a coffin. There are no pine boxes here. Your daughter's body is in a cooler.
My poor baby must be so cold,
she cries. Julie doesn't feel the cold, Mrs. Paulson, Scarpetta says kindly. She's not feeling any discomfort or pain, I promise.
You've seen her?
Yes, I have, Scarpetta replies. I examined her.
Tell me she didn't suffer. Please tell me she didn't.
But Scarpetta can't tell her that. To tell her that would be a lie. There are a lot of tests still to be done, she replies. The labs will be doing tests for quite some time. Everybody's working very hard to find out exactly what happened to Jilly. Mrs. Paulson cries quietly as Scarpetta leads her down the corridor, back to the administrative offices, and asks one of the clerks to leave her cubicle to give Mrs. Paulson copies of the report she has requested, and to release Jilly's personal effects, which are a pair of gold heart earrings and a leather bracelet, nothing more. Her pajamas and bedding and whatever else the police gathered are considered evidence and aren't going anywhere right now. Scarpetta is just walking back to the conference room when Marino appears, walking quickly along the corridor, his head bent and face flushed. Not a good morning so far, she comments when he walks up. Not for you either, it appears. I've been trying to get hold of you. I guess you got my message. What's she doing here? He blurts out, referring to Mrs. Paulson, and visibly upset. Picking up Julie's personal effects, copies of reports. She can do that when they can't even decide who gets her body? She's next of kin. I'm not sure what reports they're releasing to her. I'm not sure of anything that goes on around here, she says. The FBI's shown up for the meeting. I don't know who else has or will. The latest twist is that Frank Paulson allegedly sexually harasses female pilots. Huh. Marino is in a hurry and acting perfectly bizarre, and he smells like booze and looks like hell. Are you all right? She asks. What am I saying? Of course you're not.
It's no big deal, he says.
Chapter 26. Marino heaps sugar into his coffee. He must be in very bad shape to take refined white sugar, because it is off limits in his diet, absolutely the worst thing he can put into his mouth right now. You sure you want to do that to yourself? Scarpetta asks. You're going to be sorry.
What the hell is she doing here?
He stirs in another spoonful of sugar.
I walk in the morgue and there's the kid's mother walking down the hallway. Don't tell me she was viewing Jilly because I know she isn't viewable. So what in the hell was she doing here?
Marino is dressed in the same black cargo pants and windbreaker and LAPD baseball cap, and he hasn't shaved, and his eyes are exhausted and wild. Maybe after the FOP lounge he went out to see one of his women, one of those low-life women he used to meet in the bowling alley and get drunk with and sleep with. If you're going to be in a mood, maybe it's better you don't go into the meeting with me, Scarpetta says. They didn't invite you, so I don't need to make matters worse by showing up with you when you're in a mood. You know how you get when you eat sugar these days.
Huh, he says, looking at the closed conference room door. Yeah, well, I'll show those assholes a mood.
What's happened?
There's talk going around, he says in a low, angry voice. About you.
Talk going around where? She hates the kind of talk he means and usually pays little attention to it.
Talk about you moving back here, and that's really why you're here.
He looks accusingly at her, sipping his poisonously sweet coffee.
What the hell are you holding back from me, huh?
I wouldn't move back here, she says. I'm surprised you would listen to baseless, idle talk.
I ain't coming back here, he says, as if the talk is about him and not her. No way. Don't even think about it.
I wouldn't think about it. Let's don't think about it at all right now. She walks on to the conference room and opens the dark wooden door. Marino can follow her if he wants, or he can stand out by the coffee machine eating sugar all day. She isn't going to coax or cajole him. She'll have to find out more about what's bothering him, but not now. Now she has a meeting with Dr. Marcus, the FBI, and Jack Fielding, who stood her up last night, and whose skin is more inflamed than when she saw him last. No one speaks to her as she finds a chair. No one speaks to Marino as he follows her and pulls out a chair next to hers. Well, this is an inquisition, she thinks.
Let's get started, Dr. Marcus begins. I guess you've been introduced to Special Agent Weber from the FBI Profiling Unit, he says to Scarpetta, calling the unit by the wrong name.
It is the Behavioral Science Unit, not the Profiling Unit.
We have a real problem on our hands, as if we didn't have enough problems.
His face is grim, his small eyes glittering coldly behind his glasses.
Dr. Scarpetta, he says loudly, you re-autopsy Jilly Paulson, but you also examined Mr. Whitby, the tractor driver, did you not?
Fielding stares down at a file folder and says nothing, his face raw and red.
I wouldn't say I examined him, she replies, giving Fielding a look.
Nor do I have any idea what this is about.
Did you touch him? Asks Special Agent Karen Weber.
I'm sorry, but is the FBI also involved in the tractor driver's death? Scarpetta asks.
Possibly. We'll hope not, but quite possibly, says Special Agent Weber, who seems to enjoy questioning Scarpetta, the former chief.
Did you touch him?
It is Dr. Marcus who asks this time.
Yes, Scarpetta replies, I did touch him.
And, of course, you did, Dr. Marcus says to Fielding. You did the external examination and began the autopsy, and then at some point joined her in the decomp room to re-examine the Paulson girl.
Oh, yeah, Fielding mutters, glancing up from his case file, but not looking at anyone in particular.
This is bullshit.
What did you say? Dr. Marcus asks.
You heard me. This is bullshit, Fielding says. I told you that yesterday when this came up. This morning I'll tell you the same damn thing. It's bullshit. I'm not going to be hung on some cross in front of the FBI or anyone else.
I'm afraid it isn't bullshit, Dr. Fielding. We have a major problem with the evidence. The trace evidence recovered from Jilly Paulson's body seems identical to trace evidence recovered from the tractor driver, Mr. Whitby. Now, I just don't see how that's possible unless there's been some sort of cross-contamination. And by the way, I also don't understand why you were looking for trace evidence in the Whitby case to begin with. He's an accident, not a homicide. Correct me if I'm wrong.
I'm not prepared to swear to anything, Fielding replies, his face and hands so raw it is painful to look at them.
He was crushed to death, but how that happened remains to be proven. I didn't witness his death. I swabbed a wound on his face to see if there might have been any grease, for example, in the event someone comes forward and says he was assaulted, hit in the face with something, as opposed to being just run over.
What's this about?
What trace? Asks Marino. And he is surprisingly calm for a man who has just shocked his system with a dangerous dose of sugar.
Frankly, I don't consider this any of your business, Dr. Marcus says to him. But since your colleague insists on having you in tow wherever she goes, I must accept that you're here. I must in turn insist that what is said in this room stays in the room.
Insist away, Marino says, smiling at Special Agent Weber. And to what do we owe the pleasure? He asks her. I used to know the unit chief up there in Marine Corps land. Funny how everyone forgets that Quantico is more about the Marines than it is the FBI. Ever heard of Benton Wesley? Of course. Ever read all the shit he's written about profiling?
I'm very familiar with his work, she says, her fingers laced on top of a legal pad, her long nails flawlessly manicured and painted deep red.
Good. Then you probably know he thinks profiling's about as reliable as fortune cookies, Marino says.
I didn't come here to be abused, Special Agent Weber says to Dr. Marcus.
Gee, I sure am sorry, Marino says to Dr. Marcus. It's not my intention to run her off. I'm sure we could use an expert from the FBI profiler unit to tell us all about trace evidence.
That's quite enough, Dr. Marcus says angrily. If you can't behave as a professional, then I must ask you to leave.
No, no, don't mind me, Marino says. I'll sit here nice and pretty and listen. Go right ahead.
Jack Fielding is slowly shaking his head, staring down at the file folder.
I'll go ahead, Scarpetta says, and she no longer cares about being nice or even diplomatic.
Dr. Marcus, this is the first you've mentioned of trace evidence in Jilly Paulson's case. You call me to Richmond to help with her case and then fail to tell me about trace evidence? She looks at him, then at Fielding.
Don't ask me, Fielding tells her. I did the swabs. I didn't get the report back from the labs, not even a phone call. Not that I usually do anymore, at least not directly. I only heard about this late yesterday when he means Dr. Marcus, mentioned it to me as I was getting into my car.
I didn't find out until late in the day, Dr. Marcus snaps. One of those inane little notes that what's-his-name, Ice or Eyes, is always sending me about the way we do things, as if he could do them better. There was nothing especially helpful about what the labs have found so far. A few hairs and other debris, including possible paint chips that I suppose could have come from anywhere, including an automobile, I suppose, or something inside the Paulson house. Perhaps even a bicycle or a toy.
They should know if the paint is automotive, Scarpetta replies. Certainly they should be able to match it back to anything inside the house.
I think my point is that there is no DNA. The swabs were negative for that. And of course, if we're thinking a homicide, DNA on a vaginal or oral swab would have been very significant. I was more focused on whether there was DNA than on these alleged paint chips until I get this email late yesterday from Trace Evidence and come to find out the astonishing fact that the swabs you took on the tractor driver apparently have this same debris on them.
Dr. Marcus stares at Fielding.
And this so-called cross-contamination would have happened how, exactly? Scarpetta asks.
Dr. Marcus raises his hands in a slow, exaggerated shrug.
You tell me.
I don't see how, she replies. We changed our gloves, not that it matters, because we didn't swab Jilly Paulson's body again. That would have been an exercise in futility after she's been washed, autopsied, swabbed, washed again, and re-autopsied after being stored inside a pouch for 2 weeks.
Of course you wouldn't have swabbed her again, Dr. Marcus says, as if he is very big and she is very small. But I'm assuming you weren't finished autopsying Mr. Whitby and perhaps returned to him after re-examining the Paulson girl.
I swabbed Mr. Whitby, then worked on the Paulson girl, Fielding says. I did not swab her. That's clear. And there couldn't have been any trace left on her to transfer to him or anyone else.
This isn't for me to explain, Dr. Marcus decides. I don't know what the hell happened, but something did. We have to consider every possible scenario, because you can rest assured that attorneys will, should either case ever go to court.
Jilly's death will go to court, Special Agent Weber says, as if she knows this for a fact and is personally connected to the dead 14-year-old. Maybe there's been some kind of mix-up in the lab, she then considers. Some sample mislabeled, or one sample contaminated another sample. Did the same forensic scientist do both analyses?
Eyes, I guess that's his name, did them both, Dr. Marcus answers. He did the trace, or is doing the trace, but not the hair.
You've mentioned hair twice. What hair? Scarpetta asks. Now you're telling me hair was recovered.
Several hairs from the Jilly Paulson scene, he replies. I think from the bed linens.
Let's hope like hell it ain't the tractor driver's hair, Marino remarks. Or maybe you should hope it is. He kills the girl, then can't take the guilt and runs himself over with his tractor. Case exceptionally cleared.
No one thinks he is funny. I ask that her bed linens be checked for ciliated respiratory epithelium, Scarpetta says to Fielding.
The pillowcase, he says. The answer's yes.
She should be relieved. The presence of that biological evidence suggests that Jilly was asphyxiated. But the truth hurts her deeply.
An awful way to die, she says. Perfectly awful.
I'm sorry, Special Agent Weber says. Am I missing something? The kid was murdered, Marina replies. Other than that, I don't know what the hell you're missing.
You know, I really don't have to put up with this, she says to Dr. Marcus.
Yeah, she really does, Marina says to him. Unless you want to pry me out of this room yourself. Otherwise, I'm just going to sit here nice and pretty and say whatever the hell I want.
While we're having this open, honest conversation, Scarpetta says to the special agent, I'd like to hear directly from you why the FBI is involved in Jilly Paulson's case.
Very simply, the Richmond police asked for our assistance, Special Agent Weber replies.
Why?
I suppose you should ask them that.
I'm asking you, Scarpetta tells her. Someone's going to shoot straight with me, or I'm walking out of this office and not coming back.
It's not quite that simple.
Dr. Marcus looks at her long and steady with heavy-lidded eyes, reminding her of a lizard.
You've involved yourself. You examined the tractor driver, and now we have possible cross-contamination of evidence. I'm afraid it's not as easy as your just walking out and not coming back. The choice is no longer yours to make.
This is such bullshit,
Fielding mutters again, staring down at his raw, scaly hands in his lap.
I'll tell you why the FBI's involved.
It is Marino who offers this.
At least I'll tell you what the Richmond PD has to say about it if you really want to know. It might hurt your feelings, he says to Special Agent Weber. And by the way, did I mention how much I like your suit and your red shoes? Love 'em. But what happens if you get into a foot pursuit in those things?
I've had enough, she says in a smoldering tone.
No, I've had enough.
Jack Fielding suddenly slams his fist on the table and is on his feet. He steps back from the table and looks around it with flashing, enraged eyes.
Fuck all of this. I quit. Do you hear me, you little numbnut asshole? He says to Dr. Marcus. I quit. And fuck you, too.
He jabs a finger in the air, poking his index finger at Special Agent Weber.
You stupid fucking feds coming in here like God and you don't know shit. You couldn't work a fucking homicide if it happened right in your own fucking bed. I quit!
He backs toward the door.
Go ahead, Pete. I know you know, he says, staring at Marino. Tell Dr. Scarpetta the truth. Go on. Someone should.
He strides out the door and shuts it loudly. After a stunned silence, Dr. Marcus says,
Well, that was quite something. I apologize, he says to Special Agent Weber.
Is he having a nervous breakdown? She asks.
Is there something you need to say? Scarpetta looks at Marino. And she is more than a little unhappy that he might have information he hasn't bothered to pass on to her. She wonders if he stayed out all night drinking and didn't bother to let her know information that could make a difference.
From the way I hear it, he replies, the feds are interested in little Jilly because her dad's a snitch, you might say, for Homeland Security. He's down there in Charleston supposedly snitching on pilots who might have terrorist inclinations. And that's a big worry down there, since they've got the biggest fleet of C-17 cargo planes in the country, each one about $185 million a pop. Wouldn't be a good thing if some terrorist pilot suddenly crashed a plane into that fleet, now would it?
It probably would be a good idea for you to shut up right about now, Special Agent Weber says to him, her fingers still laced on top of her legal pad, but her knuckles are white.
You don't want to be getting into this.
Oh, I'm in it, he replies, taking off his baseball cap and rubbing the sandy stubble sprinkled over his otherwise perfectly bald head.
Sorry, I was up kind of late and didn't have time to shave this morning.
He rubs his stubbly jaw, and it scratches like sandpaper.
Me and forensic scientist Eyes and Detective Brownen had a bonding moment at the FOP, and then I had a few other chats I won't go into for confidentiality reasons.
You can stop right now, FBI Special Agent Weber warns him, as if she might arrest him for talking, as if talking is a new federal crime. Maybe in her mind, he is about to commit treason.
I'd rather you didn't stop, Scarpetta says. The FBI and Homeland Security don't like each other much, Marino says. See, a big chunk of Justice's budget has been forked over to Homeland Security, and we all know how much the FBI likes a big fat budget. What is it last I heard?
He looks coolly at Special Agent Weber.
About 70 lobbyists on Capitol Hill, every one of them there to beg for money, while all you empty suits run around trying to take over everybody's jurisdiction, take over the goddamn world.
Why are we sitting here listening to this? Special Agent Weber asks Dr. Marcus.
The story is, Marino says to Scarpetta, the Bureau's been sniffing around Frank Paulson for a while. And you're right, there's rumors about him, all right. Seems he supposedly abuses his privileges as a flight surgeon, which is especially scary in light of him being a snitch for Homeland Security. Sure would hate for him to sign off on a pilot, especially a military pilot, because maybe he's getting favors. And nothing the Bureau would like better than to nail Homeland Security and make them look like idiots. So when the governor got a little worried about things and called the FBI, that opened the gate now, didn't it?
He looks at the special agent.
Now, I doubt the governor knows just what kind of help she asked for. Didn't realize the Bureau's idea of help was to make another federal agency look like shit. In other words, this is all about power and money. But then, ain't everything?
No. Not everything, Scarpetta replies in a hard voice. And she has had as much of this as she intends to take. This is about a 14-year-old girl who died a painful, terrifying death. It's about Jilly Paulson's murder. She gets up from her chair and snaps shut her briefcase and picks it up by its leather handles and looks at Dr. Marcus, then at Special Agent Weber. That's what this is supposed to be about. Chapter 27. By the time they reach Broad Street, Scarpetta is ready to get the truth out of him. It doesn't matter what he wants. He is going to tell her. You did something last night, she says, and I'm not just talking about your hanging out at the FOP with whoever you were drinking with.
I don't know what you're getting at.
Marino is big and gloomy in the passenger seat, his cap pulled low over his sullen face.
Oh, yes, you do. You went to see her.
Now I sure as hell don't know what you're talking about.
He stares out his side window.
Oh, yes, you do.
She cuts across Broad at a vigorous rate of speed, driving because she insisted on it, because there was no way she was going to allow Marino or anyone else to be in the driver's seat right this minute.
I know you. Damn it, Marino. You've done this before. If you did it again, just tell me.
I saw the way she looked at you when we were at her house.
You saw it. You damn well did, and we're happy about it.
I'm not stupid.
He doesn't answer her, staring out his window, his face shadowed by the cap and averted from her.
Tell me, Marino, did you go see Mrs. Paulson? Did you meet up with her somewhere? Tell me the truth.
I'm going to get it out of you eventually. You know I will,
Scarpetta says, stopping abruptly at a yellow light turning red. She looks over at him.
Okay, your silence speaks volumes. That's why you acted so strange when you ran into her at the office this morning, isn't it? You were with her last night, and maybe things didn't go quite the way you hoped, so you got surprised this morning when you saw her at the office.
That's not it.
Then tell me.
Sue's just needed someone to talk to, and I needed information. So we helped each other out, he says to the window.
Sue's?
She helped out, now didn't she? He goes on. I got some insight about all this Homeland Security, about what a dickhead her ex-husband is, about what a sleaze he is and why the FBI might be after him.
Might be?
She swings left on Franklin Street, heading to her first office in Richmond, her former building that is being torn down.
You seem pretty sure of yourself in the meeting, if what just happened can be called a meeting. This was guessing on your part? Might be?
What are you saying exactly?
She called my cell phone last night, Marino replies. They've torn down a lot since we got here. A lot's been torn down in more ways than one.
He looks out at the demolition ahead. The precast building is smaller and more pitiful than when they first saw it. Or maybe they are no longer surprised by the destruction, and it only seems smaller and more pitiful. Scarpetta slows as she approaches 14th Street and looks for a place to park the car.
We're going to have to go up Cary, she decides. There's a pay lot just a block or two up Cary, or at least there used to be.
The hell with it. Drive right up to the building and off the road, Marino says. I've got us covered.
He reaches down and unzips his black cloth briefcase and pulls out a red chief medical examiner plate. He slides it between the windshield and dash.
Now, how did you manage that?
She can't believe it.
How the hell did you do that?
Things happen when you take time to chat with the girls in the front office.
You're very bad, she says, shaking her head.
I've missed having one of those, she adds, because once upon a time, parking was not the problem or inconvenience that it has become. She could roll up on any crime scene and park anywhere she wanted. She could show up for court during rush hour and tuck her car in some illegal spot easily, because she had a little red plate with Chief Medical Examiner stamped on it in big white letters.
Why did Mrs. Paulson call you last night?
She can't quite bring herself to call her Sue's.
She wanted to talk, he says, opening his door. Come on, let's get this over with. You should have worn boots.
Chapter 28. All the time since last night, Marino has been thinking about Sue's. He likes the way she wears her hair just long enough to brush her shoulders, and he likes it blonde. Blonde is his favorite. It always has been. When he met her at her house for the first time, he liked the curve of her cheek and the fullness of her lips. He liked the way she looked at him. She made him feel big and important and strong, and in her eyes he saw that she believed he knew what to do about problems, even though her problems are beyond fixing, no matter who she might look at. She would have to look at God himself to get her problems fixed, and that isn't going to happen. Because God probably isn't moved in the same way men like Marino are. Her looking at Marino the way she did was probably what got to him most, and when she moved close to him as they were searching Jilly's bedroom, he felt her closeness. He knew trouble was on its way. He knew if Scarpetta sensed the truth, he would hear an earful. He and Scarpetta are walking through thick red mud. And it always amazes him that she can walk through anything in the damnedest shoes, and she just keeps on going and doesn't complain. Wet red mud sucks at Marino's black boots, and his feet slip as he picks his steps carefully, and she doesn't even seem to notice that she doesn't have boots. She's wearing low-heeled black lace-up shoes that make sense and look good with her suit, or did. Now she may as well be walking on clods of red mud, and the red mud is spattering the hem of her pants and her long coat as she and Marino make their way toward the beat-up and half-ruined old building. The demolition crew stops working as Marino and Scarpetta walk like fools through rubble and mud, heading straight into all the violence, and a big man in a hard hat stares at them. He is holding a clipboard, talking to another man in a hard hat. The man with the clipboard starts walking toward them and waving his hand as if shooing them away like tourists. Marino starts motioning for the man to keep coming because they need to have a conversation. When the man with the clipboard gets to them and notices Marino's black LAPD baseball cap, he pays more attention. The cap is turning out to be a damn good thing, Marino thinks. He doesn't need to identify himself falsely, or identify himself at all, because the cap takes care of introductions. It takes care of other things, too. "I'm Investigator Marino," he says to the man with the clipboard. "This is Dr. Scarpetta, the medical examiner." "Oh," the man with the clipboard says, "you're here about Ted Whitby." He starts shaking his head. "I couldn't believe it. You probably heard about his family." "Tell me," Marino says. "Wife's pregnant with their first baby. Second marriage for Ted. Anyway, see that guy over there?" He turns back toward the busted-up building and points at a man in gray climbing out of the cab of a crane. "That's Sam Stiles. And he and Ted had their problems, let's just put it that way. She, that's Ted's wife, is saying that Sam swung the wrecking ball too close to Ted's tractor, and that's why he fell off and got run over."
"What makes you think he fell off?" asks Scarpetta.
She's wondering about what she saw, Marino thinks. She still believes she saw Ted Whitby right before he got run over. That when she saw him, he was standing on his own 2 feet doing something to the engine. Maybe what she saw is exactly right. Knowing her, it probably is.
"Don't think that necessarily, ma'am," the man with the clipboard replies.
And he is about Marino's age, but with plenty of hair and wrinkles. His skin is tanned and weathered like a cowboy's, and his eyes are bright blue.
"All I'm telling you is what the wife, the widow, I guess, is going around mouthing off to everybody. Of course she wants money. Isn't that always the way? Not that I don't feel sorry for her, but it ain't right to be blaming people for somebody getting killed."
"Were you here when it happened?" the doc asks.
"Right there, not more'n a couple hundred feet from where it happened."
He points to the front right corner of the building, or what is left of it.
"You saw it?" "No, ma'am. Nobody I know saw it exactly. He was in the back parking lot working on the engine because it was stalling. So he jumped it, is my guess, and the rest's history. Next thing I saw, or anybody else saw for that matter, was a tractor rolling off with nobody on it. And it hit that yellow pole near the bay door and got hung. But Ted was on the ground, hurt bad. He was bleeding bad. I mean, it was bad."
"Was he conscious when you got to him?" the doc asks. And as usual, she's writing notes in her little black notebook, and slung over her shoulder is a black nylon scene case that has a long strap.
"I didn't hear him say nothing."
The man with the clipboard makes a painful face and looks away from them. He swallows hard and clears his throat.
"His eyes were open and he was trying to breathe. That's mainly what sticks in my mind and probably always will. It's him trying to breathe and his face turning blue. Then he was gone, just that quick. The police got here, of course, in an ambulance, but nobody could do a thing."
Marino is just standing here in the mud, listening. And he decides he better ask a thing or two, because it makes him uneasy when he stands too long with his mouth shut, like he's stupid. Scarpetta makes him feel stupid. She doesn't try to and would never try to, and that's worse.
"This Sam Stiles guy," Marino says,
nodding his black LAPD cap toward the motionless crane and its wrecking ball that is swaying slightly from the cable attached to the boom.
"Where was he when Ted got run over? Anywhere near him?" "No, that's just ridiculous. The idea that Ted somehow got knocked off his tractor by the wrecking ball is so ridiculous it would be funny, if any of this was funny. You got any idea what a wrecking ball would do to a man?
Wouldn't be pretty, Marino comments.
Knock his brains right out of his head. Wouldn't need no tractor to run him over after that.
Scarpetta is writing all this down. Now and then she looks around thoughtfully and writes something else. One time Marino happened across her notes in plain view on her desk while she was out of the office. Curious about what goes on in her head, he took the opportunity to have a good look. He couldn't make out more than one word, and that one word happened to be his name, Marino. Not only is her writing that bad, but when she makes notes, she has her own secret language, her own weird shorthand that no one but her secretary Rose can decipher. Now she is asking the man with the clipboard his name, and he is telling her it is Bud Light, which is easy enough for Marino to remember, even if he doesn't believe in Bud Light or Miller Light or Michelob Light or anything light. She is explaining that she needs to know exactly where the body was found because she needs to take soil samples. Bud doesn't seem the least bit curious. Maybe he assumes good-looking women medical examiners and big cops in LAPD caps always take soil samples when some construction worker is run over by a tractor. So they start walking through the thick, wet mud again, getting closer to the building. And all the while this is going on, Marino is thinking about Suze. Last night he was just starting another round of whiskey at the FOP lounge, having a nice honest conversation with Junius Eyes, or Eyes-Ass, as Marino has called him for years. Browning had already gone home, and Marino was talking away when his cell phone rang. By this point he was feeling pretty good, and probably shouldn't have answered his cell phone. Probably it should have been turned off, but he hadn't turned it off because Scarpetta had called earlier when Fielding wouldn't come to the door, and Marino told her to call back if she needed him. That's the real reason he answered his cell phone when it rang. Although it is also true that when he's enjoying another round, he is, at that moment more than any other, most likely to answer the door, or the phone, or talk to a stranger.
Marino, he said above the din inside the FOP lounge.
This is Susanna Paulson. I'm sorry to bother you.
She began to cry. It doesn't matter what she said after that, and some of it he can't remember as he's picking his way through thick red mud while Scarpetta digs into her shoulder bag for packets of sterile wooden tongue depressors and plastic freezer bags. The most important part of what happened last night, Marino can't remember, and probably never will, because Suze had whiskey at her house, sour mash bourbon, and lots of it. She was wearing jeans and a soft pink sweater when she led him into the living room and drew the drapes across the windows, then sat next to him on the couch and told him about her scumbag ex-husband and Homeland Security and women pilots and other couples he used to invite to the house. She kept referring to these other couples as if it were important, and Marino asked her if these couples were who she meant when she said them several times while he and Scarpetta were here. Suze wouldn't answer him directly. She said the same thing. She said,
"Ask Frank."
"I'm asking you," Marino replied.
"Ask Frank," she kept saying. "He had all kinds in here. Ask him."
"Had them here for what reason?"
"You'll find out," she said.
Marino stands back watching Scarpetta as she pulls on latex gloves and rips open a white paper packet. There is nothing left of the tractor driver's death scene but muddy asphalt in front of a back door that is next to the huge bay door. He watches her get down and look around the muddy pavement, and he remembers yesterday morning when they were cruising by in the rental car talking about the past, and if he could go back to yesterday morning, he would. If only he could go back. His stomach is sour and stabbed by nausea. His head throbs in rapid rhythm with his racing heart. He breathes in the cold air and tastes the dirt and the concrete of the building that is falling down around them.
"So what you looking for exactly, you don't mind me asking?" Bud is saying, looking on.
She carefully scrapes a wooden tongue depressor over a small area of dirt and sand that is stained, maybe with blood. "Just checking on what's here," she explains.
"You know, I watch some of those TV shows. At least I catch a bit here and there when the wife is watching."
"Don't believe everything you see." Scarpetta drops more dirt in the bag, then drops in the tongue depressor after it. She seals the bag and marks it with more of that writing of hers that Marino can't make out. She gently tucks the bag inside the nylon scene kit, which is upright on the pavement.
"So you ain't gonna take this dirt back and put it inside some magic machine?"
Bud jokes. "No magic involved," she says, opening another white packet, as she squats in the parking lot near the door she used to unlock and walk in every morning when she was chief. Several times this morning, Marino has had flashes in the throbbing darkness of his soul. They are electrical, like a picture blinking in and out of a TV that is seriously malfunctioning, severely damaged, and blinking in and out so fast that he can't see what's there, but is given only fuzzy impressions of what might be there. Lips and tongue, fragments of hands and shut eyes, and his mouth going on her. What he knows for a fact is that he woke up naked in her bed at 5:07 this morning. Scarpetta works like an archaeologist, as much as Marino knows about an archaeologist's methods. She carefully scrapes the top of a muddy area where he thinks he might see dark spots of blood. Her coat drapes around her and drags along the filthy blacktop, and she doesn't care. If only all women cared as little as she does about things that don't matter. If only all women cared as much as she does about things that do matter. Marino imagines Scarpetta would understand a bad night. She would make coffee and hang around long enough to talk about it. She wouldn't lock herself in the bathroom and cry and holler and order him to get the hell out of her house. Marino walks off quickly from the parking lot and back through the red mud, his big boots slipping. He slips and catches himself with a grunt that turns into a heave as he vomits, bending over deeply in loud heaves, a bitter brown liquid splashing on his boots. He is trembling and gagging and believing he will die when he feels her hand on his elbow. He would know that hand anywhere, that strong, sure hand. "Come on," she says quietly, gripping his arm. "Let's get you back into the car." "It's all right. Put your hand on my shoulder, and for God's sake, watch where you step, or both of us are going down." He wipes his mouth on his coat sleeve. Tears flood his eyes as he wills one foot at a time to move, holding on to her and holding himself up as he squishes through the muddy, bloody red battlefield around the ruined building where they first met.
"What if I raped her, Doc?"
he says, so sick he might die.
"What if I did?"
Chapter 29. It is very hot inside the hotel room, and Scarpetta has given up adjusting the thermostat. She sits in a chair by the window and watches Marino on the bed. He is stretched out in his black pants and black shirt, the baseball cap lonely on the dresser, his black boots lonely on the floor. "You need to get some food in you," she says from her chair near the window. Nearby on the carpet is her mud-spotted black nylon crime scene kit, and draped over another chair is her mud-spattered coat. Wherever she has walked in the room, she has tracked red mud, and when her eyes fall on the trail she has made, she is reminded of a crime scene. And then she thinks about Susanna Paulson's bedroom, and what crime may or may not have occurred there within the past 12 hours.
"I can't eat nothing right now," Marino says from his supine position. "What if she goes to the police?"
Scarpetta has no intention of giving him false hope. She can't give him anything, because she doesn't know anything. "Can you sit up, Marino? It would be better if you sit up. I'm going to order something." She gets up from the chair and leaves behind her more bits and flakes of drying mud as she walks to the phone by the bed. She finds a pair of reading glasses in a pocket of her suit jacket and puts them on the tip of her nose, and she studies the phone. Unable to figure out the number for room service, she dials 0 for the operator and is transferred to room service. 3 large bottles of water, she orders. 2 pots of hot Earl Grey tea, a toasted bagel, and a bowl of oatmeal. "No, thank you. That will do it." Marino works himself up to a sitting position and shoves pillows behind his back. She can feel him watching her as she returns to her chair and sits down, tired because she is overwhelmed, her brain a herd of wild horses galloping in 50 different directions. She is thinking about paint chips and other trace evidence, about the soil samples in her nylon bag, about Jillian the tractor driver, about what Lucy is doing, about what Benton might be doing, and trying to imagine Marino as a rapist. He has been foolish, no, stupid with women before. He has mixed business with the personal. Specifically, he has gotten sexually involved with witnesses and victims in the past more than once, and it has cost him, but never more than he can afford. Never before has he been accused of rape, or worried that he might have committed rape. "We have to do the best we can to sort through this," she begins. "For the record, I don't believe you raped Susanna Paulson. The obvious problem is whether she believes you did or wants to believe you did. If it's the latter, then we will have to get to motive. But let's start with what you remember, the last thing you remember. And Marino," she looks at him, "if you did rape her, then we'll deal with that." Marino just stares at her from his upright position on the bed. His face is flushed, his eyes glassy with fear and pain, and a vein has popped out on his right temple. Now and then he touches the vein. "I know you probably have no burning desire to give me every detail of what you did last night, but I can't help you if you don't. I'm not squeamish," she adds. "And after all they've been through, such a comment should be funny. But nothing is going to be funny for a while."
"I don't know if I can."
He looks away from her. "What I'm capable of imagining is worse than anything you may have done," she tells him in a quiet but objective tone.
"That's right. You probably wasn't born yesterday."
"Not hardly," she says. "If it makes you feel any better, I've done a thing or two myself." She smiles a little. "As hard as that might be for you to imagine." Chapter 30. It isn't hard for him to imagine. All these years, he has preferred not to imagine what she has done with other men, especially with Benton. Marino stares past her head out the window. His plain single room is on the third floor, and he can't see the street, just the gray sky beyond her head. He feels very small inside, and has a childish urge to hide under the covers, to sleep and hope when he wakes up he'll discover that nothing has happened. He wants to wake up and discover he is here in Richmond with the doc, working a case, and nothing has happened. Funny how many times he has opened his eyes in a hotel room and wished he would find her there looking at him. Now here she is, in his hotel room, looking at him. He tries to think where to begin. Then the childish urge clutches him again and he loses his voice. His voice dies somewhere between his heart and his mouth, like a firefly going out in the dark. His thoughts about her have been long and drawn out. For years they have been. Ever since they first met, if he is honest about it. His erotic imaginings are the most skillful, creative, incredible sex he's ever had. And he would never want her to know. He could never let her know. And he has not stopped hoping something might happen with her. But if he starts talking about what he remembers, then she might get an idea of what it would be like to be with him. That would ruin any chance. No matter how remote the chance, it would be killed. To confess in detail what little he does remember would be to show her what it would be like to be with him. That would ruin it. His fantasies wouldn't survive either, and then he wouldn't even have them, never again. He considers lying. "Let's go back to when you arrived at the FOP lounge," Scarpetta says, her eyes steady on him. "What time did you go there?" Good. He can talk about the FOP lounge.
"Around 7, Marino says. I met Eyes there, and then Browning got there, and we had something to eat."
"Details," she tells him without moving in the chair, her eyes directly on his. "What did you eat, and what had you eaten during the day?"
"I thought we were starting with the FOP, not what I ate earlier."
"Did you eat breakfast yesterday?" she persists, with the same steadiness and patience she has when she talks to those left behind, after someone is annihilated by randomness or by an act of God or by a murderer.
"Had coffee in my room," he replies.
"Snacks? Lunch?"
"Nope."
"I'll lecture you about that another time," she says. "No food all day, just coffee, and then you went to the FOP lounge at 7. Did you drink on an empty stomach?"
"I started with a couple beers, then I had a steak and a salad."
"No potato or bread? No carbs? You were on your diet?"
Huh. About the only good habit I stuck to last night, that's for sure.
She doesn't answer, and he senses she is thinking that his low-carb habit isn't exactly a good habit, but she isn't going to lecture him about nutrition right now when he's sitting on a bed, miserable with a hangover and in pain and panicky because he might have committed a felony or is about to be accused of committing one, assuming he hasn't already been accused. He looks at the gray sky out the window and imagines a Richmond police unmarked Crown Victoria prowling the streets, looking for him. Hell, it could be Detective Browning himself out there ready to serve a warrant on him.
Then what? Scarpetta asks.
Marino imagines himself in the back seat of the Crown Vic, and wonders if Browning would handcuff him. Out of professional respect, he could let Marino sit in the back unrestrained, or he could forget respect and snap handcuffs on him. He would have to handcuff him, Marino decides. You drank a few beers and ate a steak and a salad starting at 7. Scarpetta prods him in that easygoing but unstoppable way of hers. How many beers exactly?
4, I think.
Not think. How many exactly?
6,
he replies. Glasses or bottles or cans? Tall ones? Regulars? What size, in other words?
6 bottles of Budweiser, regular size. That ain't all that much for me, by the way. I can hold it. 6 beers for me is like half a beer for you.
Unlikely, she replies. We'll talk about your math later.
Well, I don't need a lecture,
he mutters, glancing at her, then staring steadily at her in sullen silence. 6 beers, 1 steak, a salad at the FOP with Junius Eyes and Detective Browning. And about when did you hear the rumor that I'm moving back to Richmond? Might this have been while you were eating with Eyes and Browning?
Now you're really putting 2 and 2 together, he says crabbily.
Eyes and Browning were sitting across from him in the booth, a candle moving in the red glass globe, all 3 of them drinking beer. Eyes asks Marino what he thinks of Scarpetta, what he really thinks. Is she a big-shot doctor chief? What is she really like?
She's a big shot, but don't act like one, were Marino's exact words.
He does remember that much. And he remembers the way he felt when Eyes and Browning started talking about her getting reappointed as chief and moving back to Richmond. She hadn't said a word to Marino about any such thing, not even given him a hint, and he was humiliated and furious. That's when he switched from beer to bourbon.
I always thought she was hot,
that idiot Eyes had the balls to say, and then he switched to bourbon.
Quite a set that one's got,
he added a few minutes later, cupping his hands at his chest, grinning.
Wouldn't mind getting into the lab coat of that one. Well, you've worked with her forever, haven't you? So maybe when you've been around her enough, you don't notice her looks anymore.
Browning said he's never seen her, but he'd heard about her, and he was grinning too. Marino didn't know what to say, so he drank the first bourbon and ordered another one. The thought of Eyes looking at her body put him in a mood to punch him. Of course he didn't. He just sat in the booth and drank and tried not to think about the way she looks when she takes off her lab coat, when she drapes it over her chair or hangs it on the hook behind her door. He did his best to block out images of her taking off her suit jacket at a scene, unbuttoning the sleeves of her blouse, doing and undoing whatever is needed when a dead body is waiting for her. She has always been easy about herself. Not showing it, not conscious of what she's got and whether anyone might be looking at it when she's unbuttoning and taking off and reaching and moving, because she is work and because the dead don't care about seeing it. They're dead. It's just Marino who isn't dead. Maybe she thinks he's dead. I'll say it again. I have no plans for moving back to Richmond, Scarpetta says from her chair, her legs crossed, the hem of her dark blue pants speckled with mud. Her shoes so smeared with mud it's hard to remember they were shiny black earlier today. Besides, you don't really think I would make plans like that and not tell you, do you?
You never know, he replies.
You do know.
I ain't moving back here, especially not now.
Someone knocks on the door, and Marino's heart jumps, and he thinks of the police and of jail and court. He shuts his eyes in relief when a voice on the other side of the door says, "Room service." "I'll get it," Scarpetta says. Marino sits still on the bed, and his eyes follow her as she moves across the small room and opens the door. If she were alone, were he not sitting right here, She would probably ask who is there and look through the peephole. But she isn't worried, because Marino is right here and wears a Colt 280 semi-automatic in an ankle holster. Not that it would be necessary to shoot anyone. He wouldn't mind beating the hell out of someone, though. Right now, he would be happy to slam his big fists into someone's jaw and solar plexus, like he used to do when he boxed.
"How are you folks today?"
the pimply-faced young man in a uniform asks as he rolls in the cart. "Fine, just fine," she says, digging in a pocket of her pants and pulling out a $10 bill that is neatly folded. "You can leave it right there, thank you." She hands him the folded bill.
"Thank you, ma'am. Y'all have a really nice day now."
And he leaves, and the door shuts softly. Marino doesn't move on the bed. Only his eyes do as he watches her. He watches her loosen plastic wrap from the bagel and the oatmeal. He watches her open a pat of butter and mix the butter into the oatmeal, then sprinkle it with salt. She opens another pat of butter and spreads it on the bagel. Then she pours 2 cups of tea. She does not put sugar in the tea. In fact, there is no sugar, none at all, on the cart. "Here," she says, setting the oatmeal and a cup of strong tea on the table by the bed. "Eat." She walks back to the cart and carries the bagel to him. "The more you eat, the better. Maybe when you start feeling better, your memory will have a miraculous recovery." The vision of the oatmeal causes a protest that rocks his gut. But he picks up the bowl and slowly dips in the spoon, and the spoon digging into the congealing oatmeal makes him think of Scarpetta digging the tongue depressor into the mud on the pavement. And then he imagines something else similar to oatmeal that causes another wave of disgust and remorse. If only he had been too drunk to do it. But he's done it. Seeing the oatmeal makes him certain he did it last night, finished what he started.
"I can't eat this," he says.
"Eat it," she replies, sitting back in the same chair like a judge, sitting up straight, looking right at him. He tastes the oatmeal and is surprised that it's pretty good. It feels good going down. Before he knows it, he's eaten the entire bowl and is working on the bagel. And while he's doing this, he can feel her watching him. She isn't talking, and he knows damn well why she's not saying anything and is watching him. He hasn't told her the truth yet. He is holding back the details that he is certain will kill the fantasy. Once she knows, he'll have no chance, and the bagel is suddenly dry in his throat, and he can't swallow it. "Feel a little better? Drink some of the tea," she suggests. And now she really is a judge, dressed in dark clothes, sitting upright in the chair beneath the gray window. "Eat all of the bagel and drink at least 1 cup of the tea. You need food, and you're dehydrated. I've got Advil."
"Yeah, Advil might be good," he says, chewing.
She reaches down into her nylon bag, and pills rattle as she pulls out a small bottle of Advil. He chews and gulps tea, suddenly very hungry, and he watches her walk back to him again, all the way to where he is propped against the pillows, and she removes the childproof cap easily, because anything childproof may as well not exist when it gets into her hands. She shakes out 2 pills and places them in his palm. Her fingers are agile and strong and seem small against his huge palm, and they lightly brush his skin, and her touch feels better to him than most things he has felt in life.
"Thanks," he says as she returns to her chair. "She'll sit in that chair for a month if she has to," he thinks. "Maybe I should just let her sit there for a month. She's not going anywhere until I tell her. I wish she'd quit looking at me like that."
"How's our memory doing?" she asks.
"Some things are lost for good, you know. It happens," he replies, draining the cup of tea and concentrating on the pills to make sure they haven't gotten stuck somewhere in his throat.
"Some things never do come back," she agrees, "or were never completely gone. Other things are just hard to talk about. You were drinking bourbon with eyes and browning. Then what? About what time was it when you started on the bourbon?"
"Maybe 8:39. My cell phone rings, and it was Suze. She was upset and said she needed to talk to me. Asked if I could come by her house."
He pauses, waiting for Scarpetta's reaction. She doesn't have to say it. She is thinking it. "Please continue," she says.
"I know what you're thinking. You're thinking I shouldn't have gone over there after drinking a few."
"You have no idea what I'm thinking," she replies from her chair.
I was feeling all right.
Define few, she adds.
The beer, a couple bourbons.
A couple?
No more than three.
6 beers equals 6 ounces of alcohol. 3 bourbons is another 4 or 5 ounces, depending on how well you know the bartender, she calculates. Let's say over a 3-hour period. That equals approximately 10 ounces. I'm being conservative. Let's say you metabolized 1 ounce per hour. That's the norm. You still had at least 7 ounces on board when you headed out of the FOP lounge.
Shit, he says. I sure could do without the math. I was feeling all right, I'm telling you, I was.
You hold it well, but you were legally drunk, more than legally drunk, the doctor lawyer says. By my calculations, more than 0.10. You got to her house safe and sound, I presume. And by now it is what time?
10:30, maybe. I mean, I wasn't looking at my watch every damn minute.
He stares at her and feels dark and sluggish, slumped against pillows on the bed. What happened next heaves darkly inside him, and he doesn't want to step into that darkness. I'm listening, Scarpetta says. How are you feeling? Do you need some more tea? More food? He shakes his head no, and feels again for the pills, worried they might be stuck somewhere and burning holes inside his throat. He burns in so many places, 2 more little burns might be hard to detect, but he doesn't need them. The headache better?
You ever been to a shrink? He suddenly asks. 'Cause that's what I'm feeling like I'm sitting in a room with a shrink. But since I ain't never been to a shrink, I don't know if it feels like this. I thought you would know.
He isn't sure why he said it, but it came out. He looks at her, helpless and angry and desperate to do anything that keeps him out of the heaving darkness. Let's not talk about me, she replies. I'm not a shrink, and you know that better than anyone. This isn't about why you did what you did or why you didn't. This is about what. What is where trouble lies or doesn't. Psychiatrists don't care much about what.
I know. What is it? What sure as hell is the problem, all right? I don't know what, Doc. That's a God's truth,
he lies. We'll back up a little. You got to her house. How? You didn't have the rental car.
Taxi.
You have the receipt?
Probably in my coat pocket.
It would be good if you still have it, she suggests.
It should be in a pocket.
You can look later. What happened next?
I got out and walked to the door. I rang the bell, she came to the door and let me in.
The heaving darkness is right in front of his face now, like a storm about to break open on top of him. He takes a deep breath, and his head throbs. Marino, it's all right, she says quietly. You can tell me. Let's find out what. Exactly what. That's all we're trying to do. End of Disc 7.